Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we're listening to the audio of a video I produced called Are You a Transhuman? Remembering FM 2030. As you'll hear, FM was a radical, seminal thinker and a continuing inspiration to many. To see the video, visit changesurfer.com and look for the link attached to this show. FM 2030 was a visionary, but he could not have imagined that 2 short years after his death, his ideas would be brought to prominence by reactionary opponents of progress, warning against the coming of techno-sapien post-humanity. Although FM 2030 had long been championed by the small transhumanist subculture that he helped birth, it wasn't until 2002, with the publication of Our Post-Human Future by the influential conservative intellectual Francis Fukuyama, and the appointment of Leon Kass as chair of the President's Council on Bioethics, that determined critics of the transhuman transition were suddenly at the pinnacle of Washington punditry, working with the Christian right to fight all the trends that FM had taught were inevitable and welcome. Political globalization, animal rights, the decline of the nuclear family, and our imminent post-human, post-biological existence. FM 2030 was born Feridun M. Esfandiari in Belgium in 1930. Son of an Iranian diplomat and part of the aristocratic Esfandiari clan, his childhood was spent in consulates, embassies, and government outposts around the world. His formal education began in an Iranian primary school, continued in an English school, a French Jesuit school in Jerusalem, and a term in a girls' convent school in Lebanon, where he was the only boy. In the late 1940s, after attending schools in Europe, he went to the United States and attended Berkeley, then UCLA. He came to London in 1948 as a member of the Iranian team at the Olympic Games. FM served at the United Nations on the Conciliation Commission for Palestine, later leaving to devote his time to writing. Day of Sacrifice, FM's first novel, was selected by the New York Herald Tribune as one of the best novels of 1959. It's been translated into 11 languages and is on the required reading list of the U.S. State Department. The critique of social conditions in Iran in Day of Sacrifice and his next novel, The Beggar, made it difficult for FM to return to Iran, however. In his third novel, Identity Card, a man searches for every possible way to obtain an identity card that will allow him to leave Iran. In the mid-1960s, FM moved from writing novels to writing nonfiction about the future. And in the process, he changed his name to FM 2030.
Why do you have the name FM 2030?
Well, for one thing, the future is unusual, right? And I'm a futurist. I spend a lot of my time in the future. And somewhere along years ago, I decided maybe it's time to jettison my old conventional name and adopt something that evokes the future. And since I spend so much of my time surfing across the decades to come, I decided to pick a name like 2030, meaning the year 2030, which according to my best projections will be an exciting time. Space colonization, people flitting from one space colony or lunar base to another, and agelessness, really people living indefinitely and so forth and so on, and a lot of abundance and so forth. Anyway, a lot of problems that exist today will certainly not exist then or will be in phase out. We'll have a lot of other problems, but certainly not the problems that we are mired in now. And so That's the reason. Names, conventional names, usually evoke nationality, territoriality, occupation, religion, ethnicity, and so forth. And these are really things that I jettisoned a long time ago.
Over the next 30-odd years, FM 2030 would become known for provocative visions of the future. He spread his ideas through teaching futurist philosophy at New School for Social Research and UCLA, guest lecturing at the Smithsonian Institution, writing opinion pieces for the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times, and appearing on television shows such as The Today Show, Good Morning America, Live with Larry King, and Future Watch. In the 1970s, FM 2030 penned his futurist trilogy, Telespheres, Upwingers, and Optimism One, The Emerging Radicalism. He also started the Upwinger Organization to discuss and promote radical optimism about and openness to the future. For instance, FM and the Upwingers were sure that radical life extension would be achieved in the 21st century.
We began our interview with a man who calls himself FM 2030 at, of all places, a hospital. The same Atlanta hospital where he'd undergone emergency surgery just a few weeks earlier. FM says in the future, hospitals won't just fix our ailing bodies, they'll issue replacements.
We will not only be able to replace very nearly any part, any malfunctioning part of the body, but we'll be able to do something infinitely more, I think, exciting. And that is, we just give the person a new body.
Whole body.
Whole body. Parts. Yeah, yeah. Replacement body.
One fell swoop or piece by piece?
Well, either way, and probably both ways.
FM says the number of people walking around today with transplanted organs, artificial limbs, and synthetic body parts is proof that the ultimate makeover is only a matter of time.
You know, if we are able to build bridges and ships and even buildings that last for hundreds of years, why can't we build bodies that can last for hundreds of years? Or bodies that can be easily jettisoned or easily replaced? And I believe we will. Millions of people around no longer have the old, pristine, specifically biological bodies. Our bodies are now, they have a lot of synthetic parts, right? And which enable people to go on living. People would have been dead and gone 10, 20, 30 years ago, now have replacement parts which enable them to move on. Spare parts. If, for example, one's kidney doesn't work, jettison it and get a new one. If your liver doesn't work, if your knee or whatever, the point is that we are grafting and incorporating increasingly non-biological parts to our bodies. And where will this all lead to? Well, as I see it, using my remote scanners, is that in the coming years and decades, we'll move toward the totally non-biological bodies which will enable us to live indefinitely into the future. So a confluence of all these things, and of course the creation of ultra-intelligent systems, which one day will enable us to piggyback on them and coast into the future, a lot of all these things happening at the same time will in the coming years help propel us toward a new entity, a post-biological, extraterrestrial entity, which by no stretch of definition can be called human. We've come a long ways from the old sexism and racism. I think we're also going to outgrow ageism in the 1990s as more and more people live longer and longer.
And as I get older, I hope so.
Well, yes, you're still a young, young kid, yeah. But the point is that more and more people are, you know, living to their 80s and 90s and 100. And this is going to keep expanding and accelerating. For example, recently I noticed that a man in his 60s was considered the sexiest person in America, a movie actor. 10 years ago it was a person in their 50s. Another 10 years it will be a person in their 70s. And so how old one is will matter less and less. Am I too old for this? Am I too young for this? Am I too young for this person? Am I too old for this person? You know, all these will begin to phase out as people stay younger longer. In fact, there's a term that NIH came up with, not my term by the way, called youth creep. Not a terribly elegant term, but the idea is that youth is creeping up. People are staying younger longer than ever.
And then coast for another 20, 30 years, and then let me tell you, my dear ones, if you're around in the year 2030, 2040, no matter what your age, no matter what your condition, you will be able to coast to indefinite lifespans. I said this 30 years ago in the New York Times interview, some of you may remember, at the time we gave courses at the New School. And as we get closer to the year 2010, let me reiterate a prediction made then. If you're around in the year 2010, there's a very good chance you'll be around in the year 2030. If you're around in the year 2030, there's a very good chance you'll be able to live indefinitely.
Unfortunately, despite a very healthy lifestyle, on July 8, 2000, at the age of 69, FM 2030 succumbed to pancreatic cancer. He was put into cryonic suspension at the Alcor Life Extension Foundation in Scottsdale, Arizona, where he remains today. FM, like many cryonauts, was very optimistic that future nanotechnology would be able to repair and revive his frozen brain and body.
Now, could you explain cryonics? What is
well,
it exactly?
For example, currently, if a person dies or is about to die, we allow the person to really go forever. We either bury the person or we let this person be cremated. Well, this is a terrible waste, and as I see, it's an irreversible waste. There is no way you can bring this person back. And whereas, you know, cryonics, life suspension, and life support systems, which are, by the way, available in hospitals and so on, are going to be two methods to allow individuals who are either near death or who actually have died to be put in suspension, to be put on hold until a time, 10, 20, 30 years from now, when in fact we will be able to reanimate the person and correct the flaw or the breakdown or whatever the glitch was and have the person go on living.
Have they defrosted anyone yet?
They haven't reanimated anyone.
Re-animated.
There are a lot of people walking around who need defrosting, yes.
As it is, right.
Who need thawing out. A lot of people in government, for example. But the thing is, we have put people in suspension. We have a lot of people in suspension, but nobody has been brought out. Although I need to add that at hospitals, for example, through a lot of what is called emergency techniques, people who have drowned have been brought back. So we are already reanimating the dead. Cardiopulmonary resuscitation, for example, is a case in point, either manual or using technology. Defibrillators, pacemakers, etc., enable people, for example, who would have been dead and gone 10 or 20 years ago to be reanimated or to go on functioning. So we are really living at an extraordinary time, extraordinary breakthroughs and advances in all areas of life, both in technology as well as in our values, in our level of humanity. And all these things are happening. But the main thing to do is to ask yourself, what does all this mean to me? How am I faring in this environment of this dynamic environment? Am I moving along? Am I staying progressive?
In the 1950s, the biologist Julian Huxley had defined transhumanism as humanism which takes seriously the idea of humanity transcending itself. But it was FM 2030 who popularized the concepts of post and transhumanity as logical and attractive next steps, especially with his 1989 book, Are You a Transhuman?
What do you mean by the title, transhuman?
It means the stage beyond the human. This very day, there are scientists who, through, let's say, biological engineering and genetics and robotics and what we call transgenesis and so forth, creating the beginnings of what will eventually be life forms more advanced, more refined, more evolved than us humans, including ourselves, by the way, Larry.
And in the process, less and less human? FM 2030 says yes.
The fact that we're no longer of this planet only, and the fact that we're no longer confined to these bodies, leads me to foresee a time very short, very, very shortly, I'd say in the coming 2-3 decades, when in fact by no stretch of imagination, by no stretch of definition, can anyone be called human. We are already trans-biological, trans-solar beings, and therefore we are transhuman. And even transhuman is not our final destination. It's just a transitional phase from the human to something infinitely more advanced, infinitely more refined, infinitely more sophisticated, and that is the post-humans of the middle of the 21st century.
What is a transhuman?
Transhuman, you know, way back in the 1960s, a lot of things were happening at the same time. Like we had the beginning of the space colonization, or rather space program. We had accelerated pace in implantology and prostheses and replacement parts and so forth. In addition, there seemed to be a whole new spirit and new set of values struggling to come to the fore and all. And the thought occurred to me, registered on my screen, that maybe what was happening was that we were moving toward the creation of or emergence as entirely new beings. Mm-hmm. We humans are specific products of this specific planet. Mm-hmm. We are earthlings. We are terrestrial beings. But, you know, we're no longer really terrestrial, right? This very moment, as you and I talk, there are several fellow humans, actually transhumans, who are out in Earth orbit.
Well, they don't know they're called transhumans, though.
They don't know. But we who have the big picture on our screens, we know that they ain't humans.
So you're saying we will become, we'll move beyond transhuman, which is the movement occurring right now, into post-human.
That's right.
Where we're partially human and partially a mechanical operative, like partly computer, partly animated to function properly.
Well, listen, when you talk of mechanical, there's nothing more mechanical than humans.
There's a lot of truth to that.
In fact, the more primitive the life form, let's say an ant or a rodent of some kind, mice, rats, and we humans, the more primitive we are, the more mechanical we are. I mean, we breathe in, we breathe out, we have to eat at certain hours, we have to sleep every few hours every night. If we don't, our whole system breaks down. We malfunction, we break down, etc. So I would be very careful about the word mechanical. We started out as highly mechanical, automated beings. We are moving toward entities or organisms that will be much more difficult to predict and much more sophisticated, where in fact we will have extraordinary viability out in space, as I say, even in interstellar space.
FM 2030 believed that technological progress would bring radical abundance and that automation would eliminate the necessity of paid employment. He also foresaw the coming of a wired world which would permit telecommuting and globalization of employment. In 1980, he wrote about teleconferencing, telemedicine, and teleshopping.
He says satellite technology has already created the beginnings of what he calls a telesphere world, in which people won't just talk, they'll teleconnect.
If one is teleconnected, one is plugged in, then there is no far or near. And what this is doing is recontexting the architecture of life on this planet.
Teleconnection, he says, will mean more and more of us working outside the plant or office. He concedes some jobs, the ones that require the worker to be there hands-on, will still exist, though in fewer numbers, as machines take over more and more of what passes for work in the 20th century.
But the need to drive to work every day and spend several hours there and then drive back, etc., that will probably phase out. In fact, I'm sure it'll phase out. Thanks again to telecommunication.
FM believed technology would eliminate the Malthusian and environmental constraints on population growth, introduce new energy sources, and that humanity would soon spread to the rest of the solar system.
FM 2030 says there's plenty of room left on Earth, thanks to technology that makes it possible for humans to build cities in the deserts and outposts at the poles and to live almost anywhere we want. And then there's always space.
In the coming years and decades, we will spread out across first near Earth space, low orbital, Earth orbital, obviously lunar things, Martian colonies and so forth, and later deep space, meaning beyond Mars. So space is really not a problem.
But somewhere later on, when we really move toward extensive colonization, where we begin colonizing, for example, Mars, and when we have a lunar base, and when we have, you know, habitats elsewhere on the planet and go out into what is called deep space, we obviously will have to make significant changes, in my view, in the human physiology, because these bodies are Earth-specific. They crystallized or coalesced out of specific conditions on this planet. But as we move out, where conditions are entirely different, obviously we will need more sophisticated bodies. I mean, we're not going to, for example, be eating when we're out there in, let's say, in the orbit of Neptune or in interstellar space.
FM spoke Arabic, French, Hebrew, and English. And like many futurists and cosmopolitans, he felt himself beyond national identity. He foresaw the world moving beyond the nation-state to a global, democratic, electronic democracy. He said, there are no illegal immigrants, only irrelevant borders.
And there are two things that we need. We have to accept the new and abandon some of the old. We have to accept new technology because it's the only way we're going to solve problems. Even if the technology doesn't succeed, nothing else will. We've got to gamble on the technology. And we've got to abandon some of the old. The nation state has to go away. We can no longer live with it. It's the route to destruction and suicide.
that that's a very hard concept to sell, given the current political structure of this earth and given the kind of nationalism that we're seeing just this week in Iran, for example.
No,
Mr. Esfand, you don't think it's a hard concept to sell?
Not at all, Tom. I think, in fact, if you see the world flowing rather than freezing conditions on the planet, you see that there is or there has been an accelerating shift from nationalism, which in the 1950s and the 40s was considered very revolutionary and idealistic, and it was then, as countries sought to overthrow hegemonies and imperialism and colonialism and so on, where in the 1970s and 80s we're moving increasingly to something entirely new, and that is regionalism, common markets, regional blocs, hemispherism, continentalism, and coincident with all this, globalism. I don't think nationalism is as pervasive as people presume. Not at all. Nationalism is everywhere on the retreat.
Absolutely. If you'll forgive just a half a second of saying I said so. 25 years ago, I was writing about the globalization of the market and the globalization of the economy. Are you optimism one, telespheres and upwingers, and right. People dismiss it as, you know, just too far. We are in the age, as you well know, of globalized, you know, economy, global job mobility, global telecommunication, global transportation, global infrastructures, about 2,000 international and global organizations, including, of course, the United Nations, not to mention a lot of continental, subcontinental, hemispheric, and global agencies and so forth.
Communication is only one, global transportation is yet another. The convergence of nations, the fact that, for example, the EC, meaning European Community, which again in the 1950s and 60s was not considered something that had a future. People dismissed it as something, you know, an ideal or idealistic. Today has become a powerful, powerful entity. And by the same token, there are similar movements in Africa and Asia and South America and so on. And I see that as an irreversible trend toward globalization. But, you know, I hasten to add, Nancy, globalization is not our ultimate destiny. It's not our ultimate destination.
What is our ultimate destination?
Well, I'm not sure that there are any ultimate destinations, but...
FM thought the decline of the nuclear family was inevitable and that it should be replaced by new forms of villages raising children, new models of co-parenting and family.
Is it your view that marriage is perhaps not such a good idea?
Well, I would put it differently. I think the historical forces, Phil, which spawned and sustained marriage associations, marriage systems, family systems through the ages, I think are just phasing out. All the things that family and marriage performed in the past now can be fulfilled outside of marriage. For instance, lovemaking, companionship, procreation.
But not parenthood.
Well, shared parenthood. I think we're moving away from exclusive parenthood toward shared parenthood. One of the lovely things about our times, as I see it, Phil, is that there are a whole lot of options open to the individual, of which singling is one.
Yes.
Coupling is yet another, exclusive or non-exclusive. Triads, three people linking up, for instance. Commuter links.
Yes, but who wants to be raised by a non-exclusive pair of parents? I mean, isn't
ideally
that...
everyone, because I think exclusive parenting is a very damaging thing. It tends to cause individuals to fixate on a specific set of parents and leave them vulnerable to lifelong suffering, lifelong jealousy, mm-hmm. rivalry, right. competitiveness.
Let me make sure
so
we've got you now, Mr. Esfandiari. You're saying that if someone doesn't want to get married, that's okay. And if they want to have children, that's okay too. And that child would be raised by what? A community of adults?
Yes, essentially people who share common values. And I think we're moving toward that as well. For instance, child care center is a step in that direction.
FM 2030's primer on how to prepare for life in the 21st century contains checklists you can use to gauge how ready you are for life in the future. Though some readers may never be ready for the author's dismissive view of traditions and rituals. Here's what he says about weddings.
Wedding ceremonies, these are rituals that allow two people to announce to the world that they now belong to each other. Weddings would be more honest if the bride and bridegroom peed on each other to establish their territory. Keep out, everybody, this is now my property. The idea is that we're moving away from ritual and from exclusivity and territoriality. We're growing more and more fluid, more and more global, more and more mobile.
Professional futurists are usually cautious, circumspect, and value neutral in their predictions, so as not to offend or disturb their patrons. Although FM consulted frequently for corporations and governments, he stands out for his radicalism, his commitment that the future was not only about anticipating better profit-making opportunities or methods of mass destruction, but about embodying and spreading the compassionate values necessary for a safe, humane future. From his vegetarianism to his opposition to the death penalty to his opposition to the nation state, FM was unhesitating in calling for a revolution in values.
You know, a lot of people who are progressive or who are forward-looking, even some of my fellow futurists or people who are interested in futurism and future studies, they think that to be future-oriented or to be very forward-looking means to talk high-tech or, for example, to talk space or to attend conferences in space. And what I'm suggesting is that it is also important to focus on our level of compassion. How compassionate are we? How sensitive are we to the fragility of all life? Are we able to identify with other peoples elsewhere on the planet? For example, right here in this country, that we still have such a crude and violent thing as the death penalty. Well, this doesn't make sense. A person who supports the death penalty, or a person who, for example, sits down and eats the flesh of a butchered animal, or a person who, for example, wears furs, or a person who watches violent spectacles on television, such a person, in my view, needs to take a look at its level of humanity.
The future is not just about new technology. The future is not just about the space program. The future is not just about genetics. The future is not just about neural networks. The future is not just about massive parallel processing. It's not about a lot of fancy technology. To be sure, it's about that also, but it's also about changes in values. A refinement, a progression in our values and our social processes. You can have all the technology in the world, but if our values are from the jungle, if our values are anachronistic, if they are replete with violence and intolerance and so forth, what good old fancy technology? There are people in Washington, D.C., I'm sure you've heard them, who say, let's give computers to every person. Well, that's wonderful. But we also need to pay attention to our values, and that's precisely what we are doing tonight.
Whether we get a chance to meet FM 2030 again in 50 years, and whether all of his predictions and optimisms have played out as quickly as he hoped, his example of sexy, passionate commitment to building a radically democratic and extremely attractive future continues to inspire those who read his works. As we set about building a transnational human rights and values framework for the governance of biotechnology, there could be no better exemplar of applied humanist bioethics than the life and work of FM 2030. For more information about FM 2030, visit fm2030.com. Thanks to Flora Schnall for the videotapes and materials used in this production. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.